question from Revelation 7:17. And the question came in, why are there tears in heaven that need to be wiped away by God? So that's a really good question. And so what I've done is looked at in the Bible every time in the Revelation that the word tears is used. You can see that it's used 11 times in the New Testament. There's Hebrews, and then after that you'll find Revelation 7:17 and Revelation 21:4. So the one in question is Revelation 7:17. The Lamb, which is in the midst of the throne, shall feed them, which is God's people, the 144,000 and the great multitude, and shall lead them unto living waters, or fountains of waters, and God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. And so the question came, why is God wiping away the tears? They're in heaven. Well, think about this for a moment. Revelation 21 comes after Revelation 20, right? Because Revelation 20 is pretty clear that we're going to be judging in heaven. We're going to see those that are saved and those that are lost. There's going to be a time where you realize that some of those you prayed for, some of those you loved, some of those you cared for are not in heaven. There is going to be tears in heaven. It's going to be very difficult for 1,000 years where you realize that those dear children, or my mother, my father, my wife, my son, whoever, they're not with me. They're not here. And there's going to be aching. There's going to be pain. It's going to be very difficult. Well, the time that it's mentioned again in Revelation is, as I said, in Revelation 21, which comes after chapter 20. Chapter 20 is that 1,000 years where we're going to be up in heaven being able to judge the books and or go through the books and find the judgment of the dead and the living. And so the final outcome based on God's records, etc. So when we're able to see that God has committed everything to those that are saved and those that are lost, as it says in Revelation 15, I'm actually going to turn there for a second. It says in Revelation 15, it says, I looked and beheld that in the temple, let me see, wait a minute. No, there it is. I was one verse off here. It's in verse 3. They sing a new song, or the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb. Okay, and they said, great and marvelous are thy works, Lord God Almighty. That's the Father. Just and true are thy ways, King of saints. Who shall not fear thee, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou only art holy. For all nations shall come and worship before thee. Why? Because your judgments are made manifest. So Revelation 15 is actually described just before the explanation of what happened in the seven last plagues. The seven last plagues have happened, and all of heaven is rejoicing because God has done all these wonderful things. Well, after the thousand, that's actually before the 1,000 years. After the 1,000 years, we're going to be able to rejoice again because God has done all these amazing things, saving those, and in his justice and righteousness, and even in his mercy, he laid aside those who are not willing to be saved. And so I'll go back and we'll see in the Revelation chapter 21. It's the second time. Here's what happens after the 1,000 years. God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain. Why? Because the former things that were causing us pain and death and sorrow are passed away. So I really like the idea that God has, in his mercy, shown us that there is going to be a time where he's able to wipe away all tears from our eyes, and we'll be able to enjoy a time in heaven with each other, those that are willing to be saved, those that are willing to live with a holy God and be submissive to him throughout the ceaseless ages of eternity. We'll be able to be together with him, with friends and family, those that are willing to be saved. So that will be the time after all the judgments is when God wipes away those tears. And that's why it's finally in Revelation 21, explaining a little bit of the timing of Revelation 7. I think that's what's important of Revelation 7 and 21 is 21 helps us know that the timing of Revelation 7 is in the explanation of God wiping the tears is after the 1,000 years. Okay, so that's where there will be no more tears and all those things are gone away. So I'm very thankful for that. Now, the next question that came in was one that is very common. A lot of people ask the question, and I've actually done a little bit of study in this, so I felt like I could answer. Now, I just as was mentioned with all of the other comments and statements before, if for some reason my conclusion is different than yours, please just pray for me that I'll continue to study and learn. And if you have a different understanding and you study and learn and come to where I am, then we're good. So either I go to where you are or you go to where I am. We're all growing. We're all, you know, learning. God is showing me one little word in Revelation that means a whole lot, but a little word next to that one means a lot to you. And so we're all trying to understand differently and better. So, but we all want to come into unity. That's the goal that God has for his people, right? So here's the big question. Is the 144,000 a literal number or a symbolic number, right? So some people really want to go to war over this. I don't. If you think it's literal, go for it. You know, praise the Lord. Study it and share it. Teach. It doesn't matter to me. I have come to a conclusion that is different than some. It's that it's symbolic. And the reason why is what I'll show you now. So if you don't like my conclusion, that's fine. But do me a favor. At least pay attention to why I've come to this conclusion. And so I'll share with you some of the thoughts that I've come to now, starting in this section. Now, the numbers in the book of Revelation are literal. They're actual numbers. What I mean is there's actually 1,260 days, but it's to be understood symbolically, right? So in the prophetic sense, the term 1,260, it's a literal number, but it's understood symbolically. 42 months is used also in the book of Revelation, but it also is understood symbolically. The half an hour where Christ is said to come in the seventh trumpet is also to be understood, in my mind, symbolically. The number seven churches, seven angels, seven trumpets, seven thunders, seven, all these wonderful things is to be understood symbolically. So now, with just that one little thought, that first little idea, it makes sense to me that the number 144,000, which is an actual number, like the number was heard, I heard the number, but is it to be understood symbolically? And I think we can say, based on what I just shared, yeah, that's a possibility. So let's go back and look and see what it is that we might be looking at here. Not all the tribes are there. When you look at Revelation chapter 7 and you see the 12 tribes listed, you have to ask the question, where's the tribe of Dan? And why in the world is Manasseh there? So if you're looking for literal tribes, you're looking for a literal 144,000, you have to ask the question, why are all the tribes not there? And so the literal aspect of it really seems to break down with this question. Why are not all the tribes there? And why is Manasseh brought in? Isn't Manasseh like the son of Joseph? And so you have this whole scenario where it doesn't fit, right? So I'm going to go and share again. And I do see a comment. Let's see. The chapter is symbolic. For example, there are four angels. Okay, are those angels actually holding the four corners or the winds of the earth? Or are they like the four, you know, east, west, south, north? Are they actually holding that? Or are they mentioned there as symbolically keeping the peace on the earth? Now, the four winds, is it really four gusts of wind that will be there? Or are we talking about strife? The earth, the sea, the tree, you know, or the trees, the green trees that are not to be hurt. Is God really only worried about the grounds of the earth? You know, the trees, I mean, are we talking about green peace here? And sure, it could apply, but the angels ascending from the east, are they really coming up from the east? Are angels actually ascending from the east? Or is this symbolic of something like the sun rising, which would better be translated in the Greek, where it starts out that there's a little bit of sun, and then the sun gets brighter and brighter and brighter. The seal of the living God, is there going to actually be a seal on our foreheads? Or is that symbolic of our lifestyle and what we've chosen in our thinking? And so, with this whole idea of the chapter being symbolic before and after, you wonder, like, why would we conclude that the number is literal? So, with a symbolic seal to be put symbolically on our foreheads, with the earth, the sea, and the trees to be kept safe from a symbolic wind, why should we say the number 144,000 is literal? Symbolic or literal, so like I'm saying, if you want it to be literal, fine, that's go for it, that's good. But symbolic or literal, it would be a small number. So let's just talk about that for a second. I am 100% sure that whether it is literal or symbolic, the number is small, okay? The reason why I can say that it's small is because of what we can see in the Old Testament. Now, I am completely convinced that the Bible itself, all 65 books before the book of Revelation, is what is to help us understand the book of Revelation. We can't just read the book of Revelation and come to a conclusion based on that book alone as to what the book of Revelation means. So let's go to the Old Testament, to the New Testament, and we'll see a few things that might help us understand more the idea of the 144,000 and what it will be like to be living at the end of time. I think that would be fair. And then we'll be able to show what it's like in this idea. Now, so in Genesis 4, verses 1 through 15, there's a man named Abel. Now, Abel, he represents the 144,000. What do I mean when I say that? Think about it for a second. You have Cain, who worshiped God according to the dictates of Cain's own conscience. Abel worshiped God according to the dictates of God's conscience. So, Abel was surrendering or rendering to God righteousness in accordance with God's will. Cain was yielding his own idea of obedience, not in accordance with God's will. Now, each of them gave to God something, but Abel was accepted, Cain was not. As a result of this interaction with God, the Cain and he representing all those that are on earth that don't care so much about God and his desires, but rather their own. He was jealous. He was frustrated. He rose up and actually persecuted Abel unto death. Well, as a result of this persecution, Cain received a mark. You can see that in verse 15, Genesis 4, verse 15. He received a mark. And so it's just like at the end of time, where the faithful will be rendering to God the holy time that he has asked for, whereas those that are not worshiping God according to the dictates of his conscience will be worshiping God according to their own dictates. And they will both be rendering to God something, but one will be accepted, the other will not. So the one that is not accepted will become jealous and frustrated and rise up and persecute those that are faithfully worshiping God according to the dictates of God's conscience. And what will happen? Those that persecute will end up with a mark. And so you can see in the story of Cain and Abel, there is a clear description in principles explaining to us the end of time and the mark of the beast scenario. Now, would I be fair to say that the 144,000 is represented by Abel? And you could say, no, that's not true. That's not the case because the 144,000 don't die. I agree, you're right. But in the same sense, we're talking about the mark of the beast and the seal of God scenario, the very end time principles that we find in Revelation 13. So I feel that it's safe to be able to apply this story to that group. Now, what do we find in this story of Cain and Abel? Do we find 144,000? No, we find one. One that was killed, one representing those that are alive at the end of time. Now, let's continue on because there are other stories that could be related to. Let's talk about Genesis chapter 6 and 7. There's a flood, right? And how many were spared? There was eight. And so, as it was in the days of Noah, is what Jesus had said. And you know what's interesting is Noah and his family were faithfully working for 120 years on this ark. They were following the blueprint that God had laid out. And there were lots of people that were helping at first. And it was like, wow, God's got this big group of people that are moving forward to finish this ark. It's taken 120 years, but by the time the 120 years were up, a lot of those people had kind of fallen away. They had chosen their own God, a different God. What God was it? Themselves. They wanted to serve themselves. They didn't want to fulfill or finish the work that God had laid out for them. So what does God do? He has clean beasts come into the ark and the unclean beasts. Now, the clean beasts, you could say, are those that could potentially represent those that were faithful as Christians. But then the unclean beasts, like it says in Acts chapter 10, where there's this great sheet that comes down and there's all these unclean beasts. And what did those unclean beasts represent? It represented the Gentiles. And so in the story of Noah with the unclean animals coming in, could that represent the Gentiles coming in? Remember, there's a prophecy in Sister White's writings where it says, company after company will leave and tribe after tribe will come in to take their place. Are we seeing the clean animals leaving and the unclean, you know, coming in to take their place? Well, of course, the clean animals didn't leave, you know, but you know what I'm saying. There's that kind of idea that could be fit into that. You take it or leave it if you want. It's I think, something that can be chewed on. But what we have in this story is eight people that were saved because they were following God's blueprint and they were delivered from the destruction of the entire world. Now, Peter tells us that the world's not going to be destroyed by water any longer. It's going to be destroyed by, by fire. Not by water, but by fire. And so will there be this little group at the end of time that is delivered from the destruction that are still alive? Yes, but how many are there? Were there 144,000 in the boat? No, there was only eight. And so Abel was one, Noah and his family were eight. But they represent those that are alive at the very end of time, or in Abel's case, those that are persecuted at the end of time. So think about it again here with Genesis chapter 18 and 19. You have Sodom and the destruction of Sodom, as it was in the days of Lot, remember? But how many were saved? There was only three. There was not 144,000. And so in this story, what you find is they were, how do you say that? They were sheltered in place, actually. In that story of Lot, they couldn't really go out of their home because they were surrounded as though they were besieged, like the city of Jerusalem was besieged. And who was outside but those that were wicked and trying to destroy those that were faithful, Lot and his family, and the angels, of course. So the angels, what they did is they opened the door, they blinded everybody, and Lot and his family were able to escape. And so how many were there that were delivered by the angels that was representing the 144,000 at the end of time? There was three, because remember, there was four actually, but Lot's wife turned around and looked back. Remember Lot's wife. So these three represent those that were delivered, but they were also representative of those at the end of time that will be living through the destruction, and therefore they are the 144,000 in representation. But there weren't 144,000, there was only three. So with Noah, there's eight. With Lot, there's three. With Abel, there's one. And I believe all of these represent the end of time, but we don't have a literal, physical, actual number. It's a number that changes. And so in Numbers chapter 13 verse 14, we have the wilderness. And I think we can all recall that there were only two that were faithful during that entire 40 years in the wilderness, and that was Joshua and Caleb. Is that right? Joshua and Caleb? And so Joshua and Caleb represent those that actually lived through the troubles and the trials. It wasn't everybody. The big group that started on their way to Israel, it wasn't that group. It was a small number that actually entered into the Canaan land. And it was those that didn't have fear as their God. They didn't have something else as their God. They had the one true God as their God. It was Joshua and Caleb. And they, representing the 144,000, went into the Canaan land with the young people that hadn't followed the example of their predecessors. And so what do we have in Joshua and Caleb? A representation of the 144,000. But there's only two. There's not 144,000. So I feel like that also can represent that group. And then we have Daniel chapter 3 and the furnace. Remember, there was only three that were faithful. Out of all those Israelites that came from Jerusalem to Babylon, there was only three. But they represent those that will endure the fire, the seven times hotter fire at the end of time, and they represent the 144,000. What about Daniel in chapter 6? Now, he was in the lion's den, but there was only one, and I'll tell you for sure, Daniel represents the 144,000 without question. You don't find any sin, any bait, any guile, any deceit in the mouth of Daniel. You don't find him sinning through his experience. You find him gaining victory in his life all through the trials of chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. You see that the three angels' messages is laid out in Daniel chapters 1 through 6. Chapter 1, fear God and give glory to him. How did Daniel do that? He did it through his diet and through drinking water, not Pepsi or coffee and alcohol, but he was able to endure the things that God wanted him to, even in a very strange and awkward situation. He feared God and gave glory to him. In Daniel chapter 2, it's the, the hour of his judgment has come. We know that in Daniel chapter 2, the king said, hey, everybody's going to lose their head. The king had said, the judgment hour has come. And so we know that that's typical of what we know from 1844 and onward, the hour of his judgment has come. And what's interesting in Daniel chapter 2 is God gave man, or Daniel, the gift of prophecy, the spirit of prophecy, the testimony of Jesus. And he was able to exercise that during that time with a very small number in Daniel chapter 2, which was a small number compared to all those Israelites that actually came to Babylon. So again, we have this minority that's being dealt with, not the 144,000 in number, but just a small group of four. And so what happens in Daniel chapter 3 is, instead of worshiping that which man made, worship him that made. Don't worship that which man made. And so you have fear God and give glory to him. The hour of judgment has come. Worship him that made. In Daniel chapter 4, Babylon has fallen. Why? Because he came off his throne with lycanthropic insanity for 7 years. And then, by the way, that deadly wound was healed because he came back onto his throne. In Daniel chapter 5, you have Babylon is fallen the second time, because Babylon is fallen, And the second time it was fallen is because he made all nations drink of the wine. And that's what happened in Daniel chapter 5. You have the wine that's being drank from the holy vessels from the sanctuary, and they were treating God's holy things as though it was common. You can't do that. Learn from those in the sanctuary in Leviticus chapter 10. And so Daniel chapter 6, that's what we're talking about now with the one. You see Daniel, he was there and faithful. And what we see in Daniel chapter 6 is the clearest third angel's message life experience that I know of in the entire Bible. Daniel is the one faithful. There's 122 that are unfaithful. They've come together in a fox unity. You can say F-A-U-X, you know, that fowl unity. And they have said to the king, hey, we've got this thing figured out. The king is on their side. So the king thinks that he's got this whole thing figured out because the civil leaders have come together. And what they do and what they say is, hey, we want to make laws. Okay, these laws are going to be religious in nature, because anybody who prays to anybody other than the one that we think is to be prayed to, which is the head of that Medo-Persian system, we think they should be persecuted unto death. Well, the king's like, wow, that's a great idea. How long do we have? 30 days, because the last movements will be rapid ones. Oh, okay, so 30 days, we're going to put these all things together, and there's going to be religious laws that are void of religious liberty. And there's going to be persecution unto death, and all these things are going to happen in just a short time? Yes, absolutely. And so what does he do? He signs the letter in Daniel chapter 6. And what happens when he signed that letter is church and state united, because there was these civil laws that were religious, and church and state united. And what did they do? They claimed infallibility in their law making. So why would they ever want to change any law? I mean, according to the laws of the Medes and the Persians, if we write a law, it's to be altered not. You know, you don't alter those, because we claim our laws are infallible. And so what happened as a result? Daniel continued on in his activity. He continued doing what he learned from the sanctuary, which is Bible study, prayer, and witnessing. And in that Bible study, prayer, and witnessing, he was delivered. He was spared. He was kept from that destruction of being thrown into the lion's den. where we know the devil is as a lion seeking whom he may devour. So that whole scenario of the third angel's message is summed up in Daniel chapter 6. But there's only one. There's not 144,000. And so all these numbers from the stories of Abel and Noah and Joshua and Caleb and Daniel and the three worthies, these are all types of the 144,000, except they don't have the same number. So that shows to me that the number is small, but it doesn't necessarily have to be an exact number. So let's get back to our thought here in the notes. You have Mark chapter 6 with John the Baptist, and Herod, he actually comes up as the civil leader who wants to please a harlot woman. The harlot woman in this story represents the apostate Protestants. In fact, it actually represents the Roman Catholic Church and the papacy, because the Roman Catholic Church and the papacy has a daughter. That daughter is who's mentioned in Mark chapter 6, and that daughter is the apostate Protestant churches. So you have John, the faithful Seventh-day Adventist that baptizes. You have the Herod being the civil power with the harlot woman with a daughter. So you've got all the players there, right? You have God's faithful people, America, you have the Roman Catholic papacy, and you have the apostate Protestants in America. These groups come together and they war against John the Baptizer, John the Seventh-day Adventist. How did they do that? Well, it was through charisma, through the charismatic movement. This young lady, the daughter of the harlot, she starts dancing and moving and showing the civil authorities that she can really, you know, swing her hips, and it just was like, wow, this is amazing. We need to combine. Like, I'll give you even half of my kingdom. What does that mean? I'll unite with you so that church and state is united. And so all of this play, all of this activity of John the Seventh-day Adventist is showing what will be happening at the end of time, especially and specifically with those that are dealing with the last movements that will be rapid ones. They will lose their head. That's why Revelation chapter 20 verse 4 says that those that are in heaven were those that had been beheaded for Christ's sake. And so could that be relating to some of the ways that Christians are dying today? I think it's very possible. And will that happen more in the future? Probably. I don't know. I'm not a good prophet. I can just find what God has said and try to put it in principle toward the future, but I can't tell you exactly what's going to be happening. But I think what's going on in these stories is, like John the Baptizer, he certainly represents the 144,000. But just like Cain and Abel, John the Baptizer lost his life. And so there is one. At the same time, all these other ones, they didn't lose their lives, but they represent the 144,000, just like Abel and just like John. Now, Acts chapter 1 and 2, you have the upper room. Those are the ones that received the early rain. And they are symbolic of the ones that will receive the latter rain, both the early and the latter rain, according to Zechariah 10 verse 1. So what we have in this description... Wow, my mind just went somewhere. I've got to preach that message pretty soon. God gave me a little nugget there that I've got to share sometime. Anyways, what's happening in Zechariah chapter 10 is there's the early rain and the latter rain. In the book of Acts chapter 2, it's describing that there's 120 in this upper room, and they received that early rain, which was symbolic of the latter rain. He even preached that in saying Joel chapter 2 says that there's going to be old men and young men and old women and young women that are going to prophesy and dreams. That's, of course, relating to the end of time. And as he was prophesying, it will be in the future. And so they were not 144,000, they were 120. But it wasn't 8, it wasn't 3, it wasn't 1, it wasn't 1, it wasn't another 1. It was... No, it wasn't 2, it was 120. So I feel like all of the stories here represent symbolism, or symbolically, the end of time, and they represent those that will be alive right at the time of Christ's coming. Now, I think I've made it clear there are different numbers on each of these, and these different numbers, though they are not the same number, they are all small numbers. And that's what I think is important to understand, is that numbers will be small. Now remember, John, the Revelator, he never saw the 144,000. He heard the number. It's very important to understand. But he saw the great multitude, right? That's, you can see that and read for yourself in John 7 verses, or Revelation 7 verses 4 through 9. Now, remember I said before, Revelation 1, 10 through 12, he heard a voice and he saw a candlestick in the Son of Man. So what he heard was relating to what he saw. In Revelation 5 verses 5 through 6, he heard about a lion, but he saw a lamb that had been slain. But it's relative, it's relevant. They both apply. Revelation 17, verses 1 through 3, he heard about a harlot sitting on waters, but he saw a woman sitting on a red beast. And guess what? They both apply. They're relevant to each other. Revelation 21, 9 through 10, he heard about the bride, but which is the Lamb's wife, but he saw the Holy Jerusalem. Again, they're symbolic of the same thing. It's two different ways to look at the same thing. So what we see is that John heard the number, but he saw the multitude. So I think there's a similarity there based on what happened in all these other stories and aspects of Revelation chapter 1, 5, 17, and 21, and also in chapter 7. And so the next thought is the great multitude are the ones who came out of great tribulation. Now, if you look at that phrase, great tribulation, I've found them here in my notes, but I'm actually going to go to the Bible and I'm going to search for this phrase, great tribulation. I'm going to, great tribulation with quotes, and you can find it only occurs three times in the entire Bible. Matthew 24, verse 21, for then shall be great tribulation. Such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And I do believe that was during what's called the Dark and Middle Ages. If you go ahead and study Matthew 24 for yourself, you'll realize that just before the moon was turned to blood and the sun was darkened and the stars fell from heaven as the tree is casting her untimely figs, just before all those things happened is what was described in Matthew 24 and also Revelation chapter 6. You put those things together and you realize what's happening in Revelation 6. You realize what's trying to happen in Matthew 24. And then you start putting together that it's probably dealing with, as was mentioned, the 1260 years of the Dark and Middle Ages. And then what seems to make sense to me further is, behold, it says in Revelation 2:22, I will cast her into a bed, and them that commit adultery with her into great tribulation. Wait a minute, who is this? This is the church, I believe, of Thyatira. Let me just check that real quick, because I think that's true. Yep, unto the angel of the church of Thyatira. Now, what did Thyatira represent? Thyatira represented the Dark Ages and Middle Ages church. And so it seems as though the time frame fits there in Matthew 24. It is definitely the time frame of Revelation 2. And so in Revelation 7, when it says, sir, basically, who are these people that came out of Great Tribulation? And, or let me just look at that one just to get it right, because I think I'm not quoting it correctly. Revelation 7:13, one of the elders answered and said, what are these which are arrayed in white robes, and where did they come from? And I said unto him, sir, thou knowest. And he said to me, these are they which came out of, there's our phrase, great tribulation, and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. And so when you're looking at these three times the phrase great tribulation occurs, it does not seem as though it only relates to those that are alive at the very end of time. Now, some of you might crucify me for saying that, but that's just what the Great Tribulation, if you look at that phrase, that's what it seems to describe in the book of Revelation, in the book of the Bible, every time it's used. So I'm going to go back to the notes here for a moment and see if I can notice in Revelation 7, those that are in coming out of Great Tribulation have what's called palm branches in their hands. Now, the palm branches are used during the Feast of Tabernacles, which in its fulfillment is after the 1,000 years. Now, let me describe something for a moment in the book of Revelation. You have the 7 yearly festivals in chronological order in Revelation, chapters 1 through 21. I know there are 22 chapters in Revelation, but it's actually 21 chapters that it deals with this. In the first chapter, you have the reference to the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ more than any other chapter. So what you have is Passover, unleavened bread, and the wave sheaf, okay? So, or the first fruits. Those three festivals are mentioned in type there in Revelation chapter 1 more than any other book or chapter of the book of Revelation. In chapter 5, you have the seven spirits of God being sent forth into all the earth. That's chapter 5, verse 6. That is coinciding with the time of Pentecost. You can read about that in Psalm 133, Acts chapter 2, and some other verses that I've done, put together in a message called The Anointing. You can read that over, look at that rather, on the Revelation with Daniel YouTube page. If you want a link, just please let me know. So that would be Pentecost. I may have said Passover. I meant Pentecost, if I did say that. And then the next festival in chapter 8 is trumpets. And then the next festival in chapter 11, verse 15, is where the altar of the tabernacle, or the Ark of the Tabernacle, is seen, which is only seen during the Day of Atonement. And then finally, after that, which is the final festival, is the Feast of Tabernacles, which you can see in Revelation 21. That's where God will tabernacle with his people. And the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them. The word dwell is very similar to the word tabernacle. So in these 7 yearly festivals of the book of Revelation, it's what Christ is doing through the 2,000 years that he has gone from this earth up into heaven. He's fulfilling those 7 yearly festivals. And the final one will be fulfilled in Revelation 21, which is interesting because Revelation 7 talks about those the great multitude holding palm branches. Palm branches is what they held during the time in the Festival of Tabernacles in the book of Leviticus. You can see during the Tabernacle of the Festival of Tabernacles is when they held those palm branches, which of course, when you put the idea of the tears being wiped away, it's after the 1,000 years during the time of tabernacles being fulfilled. The tabernacle of God is with men, and that's when he wipes their tears away. That's where the 144,000 and the great multitude are holding the palm branches. So the whole thing fits in together, and I think it's just amazing. And so looking again at the notes, just to read that again, palm branches are in their hands, used during the Feast of Tabernacles, which is after the 1,000 years. Now, Revelation 21:16, it says, "The city lieth four square, and the length is as large as the breadth. And he measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs. And the length and the breadth and the height of it are equal." And so notice what's happening here. You have a four square, or on all four sides, this city is the same. And the length is as large as the breadth. So it's a square. He measured the city, 12,000 furlongs on each side. The length and the breadth and the height of it are equal. So there are three things here: length, breadth, height. So I'm going to look at the length, the breadth, and the height using 12,000 for a moment. Now, do something with me here for a second. You're going to have to use your mathematical mind, your visual mind. If the building is four square, which it is, there are four sides or four corners on three of those sides. The top has four sides, so imagine on the top there's 1, 2, 3, 4, right? And there's four corners. On the bottom, there are four sides. So just like the top on the other side, there's 1, 2, 3, 4. And then there's that's the 12 corners or 12 sides. And that's the 12 sides, that's where it is. So the top, the bottom, and the sides. Okay, you have the top, okay? 1, 2, three, four. You have the bottom, one, two, three, four. You have the sides, one, two, three, four. So there's four corners, four sides, four lines going to each one. So one line, one line, one line, one line, that's four. One line, one line, one line, one line, that's four. And then on the bottom, one line, one line, one line, one line, that's four. There's three sets of four, the top, the bottom, and the sides. So just like the height, the depth, and the breadth. If you take those four lines that make up the square, you have 12. If there's 12 times 12,000 furlongs, what number do you have? 144,000. That's why here I have 12,000 times 12 equaling 144,000 K, which is 144,000. So what we have is this temple being made up, it seems, of numbers that equal 144,000. Why? Because each of us, you, me, all of us, are being prepared as living stones. In the Old Testament, I don't think I could find it right now. Maybe I could. I'm just going to try. I'm going to take a second and see if I can find it. This is building Solomon's house. The house, when it is in building, so it's when it's being prepared, it was built of stone made ready before it was brought up the mountain to where it was going to be put in place, so that there was neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron heard in the house of God while it was in building. And so what's this? I think this is telling me is that the house was in preparation down below. Okay. When it was in building, there were stones being made ready. That means there was hammers, there was chisels, there was all sorts of things going on with those stones. But when it was brought up to where the house was built, where it was actually put in place and the temple was finished, no more hammers. And so it seems to me that God's people are the living stones down below, down here on the earth. They're being prepared so that when we're brought up there, we will fit right into place. No more hammers, no more chisels. There's nothing to be hewn away or taken off, or there's no more branches that don't produce good fruit that the husbandman needs to take away. Like it says in John chapter 15, we'll be prepared. So it seems as though the 144,000 making up the dimensions of that building, the holy city, it could be relating to God's people being the temple. Why I say that is because, as was mentioned in one of the previous studies, when it says ye are the temple of God, the word ye is plural. It doesn't mean ye, like a singular you. In English, we say you, meaning singular, you. But in the Elizabethan English, when they said ye or you or your, it's plural. Thee and thou is singular. So if Paul would have said, thou art the temple of God, it would have meant you singular are God's temple. But he said, ye are the temple of God, ye, meaning plural. So God's people, all of us individual stones, are to make up that temple. And that seems to relate with the whole temple making up the number 144,000. So anyways, I feel like that is good enough to share or contemplate anyways. And we know also that this was shown years back. I saw it first by Doug Batchelor in like 96 or 7. And then I went ahead and studied it for myself, and I've kept these notes ever since. But the names of the tribes, Judah and Reuben and Gad, by the way, which are not in order, they're out of order here from their birth, because Reuben should be first. We know he was the oldest. But if you find in their first use, when they're named, what their names actually mean, you'll be able to put it together in kind of a little story, okay? Like a little last blessing of the people of God at the end of time called the 144,000. Now will I praise the Lord. For surely, and that's Judah's name, surely the Lord hath looked upon my affliction, which is Reuben's name. A troop cometh, but happy am I, for with great wrestlings have I wrestled, and God hath made me forget all my toil. For the Lord hath heard that I was hated, is what Simeon means, Now, this time will my husband be joined unto me, which is Levi. God hath given me my hire, and God hath endued me with great dowry, and God hath taken away my reproach. For I will be the son of the right hand, which is the Son of God. I will be God's son. And so these names, if, as is explained here, if you put the meaning into the line and then you add these little connecting words, then you get that meaning, which is here, and you connect it, and that meaning, which is here, found, of course, in Genesis 30, then you're able to come up with this last little bit of information that could be kind of a hidden message to the 144,000. Now, take it or leave it, that's just what I thought when I thought was interesting when I heard it first from Doug Batchelor. Now, here's some phrases or some verses in the Bible that I feel are pretty strong. Go and proclaim these words toward the north and say, return, thou backsliding Israel, saith the Lord. I will not cause my anger to fall upon you, for I am merciful, saith the Lord, and I will not keep anger forever. This is how you will not go through the anger. Only acknowledge thine iniquity, that thou hast transgressed against the Lord thy God, and hast scattered thy ways to the strangers under every green tree, and have not obeyed my voice, saith the Lord. O backsliding children, saith the Lord, for I am married unto you, and I will take you of a city, one of a city, and two of a family, and I will bring you to Zion. So just like in the story of Lot, there was three out of a family, and he originally took four out of a city, but one was left because her heart was not following the Lord's direction, but her own. And there were three of a family that were taken. It was Lot and his two daughters. And he brought them out of the city into a place that was called Zoar, where they were able to escape the plagues because they had admitted, they had acknowledged their iniquity. They had turned to the Lord and they had, you know, rejected their ways that they had accepted in Sodom, and they turned and obeyed God's, they obeyed God's voice. And so I find that these verses can apply to us at the end of time. It won't be that because you are a believer in the one true God that you're going to be saved in your whole family. Every one of us has to make a decision for ourselves. We cannot trust the faith of our father or our spouse or our children, our neighbor or our pastor. We have to understand what God saith to us for ourselves. Just yesterday, I was interacting with somebody via text, and I was trying to explain the absolute inability to understand the Trinity from the Bible. And I said, please explain to me the Trinity clearly. I used that one word in its own paragraph, clearly. I said, use the Bible and the writings of Ellen White and explain it. I want to hear. And the response came, I won't kick that dead horse. There have been people that have studied this already. I'll leave it to the theologians and just continue believing that God wants me to live righteously and turn from my iniquities. And a lot of that is right. God does want us to turn from our iniquities. But if we don't heed the first commandment to turn away from idolatry, then we're in just as much trouble as if we were breaking the one that says, thou shalt not steal, right? So we've got to be completely surrendered to God 100%, 100% of the time. I've got another quote here that I want to share with you, and I think it's really interesting. From First Selected Messages, page 174, it is not God's will that they, his people, shall get into controversy over questions which will not help them spiritually, such as, who is to compose the 144,000? So that's not a question we should ask. But notice what the statement says. This, those who are the elect of God will in a short time know without question. So that's amazing to me how Sister White can say we're not to really bother ourselves as to who will compose, but we will know. Those that are the elect will know in a short time. Now, I cannot claim to be one of the 144,000. I do believe they will be alive at the end of time. And I personally have the conviction that I may not live to the end of time. I feel like I'm a voice that's loud enough that the enemy might want to squash before that time comes, before Christ delivers us. I'm not sure. I don't know. But if God calls me to live for Him, to represent Him as one of the 144,000, I sure want to be. So I think that's what we can strive for, is wanting to be one of the 144,000, whether it's literal or symbolic. To me, it doesn't matter. But now you've seen why I feel that it can be a symbolic number, though it does represent a small number of people.